Boccaccio, Deputy Secretary General of the Council of Europe. She's going to just make an opening statement, and then we'll get on to the discussion with the panel. Maud.
Thank you very much. Well, we've just finished the forum on cybercrime, and I think this open forum of the Council of Europe, which relates to children and the internet, is in a way a natural follow-up to that. Of course, it's been often said internet offers opportunities, but there are also risks. And I would like to start with the dark side of the use of internet, and that's the emergence of certain types of crime, which have come with the internet, and which the Council of Europe has sought to address by the various tools of which we dispose, because the Council of Europe is a primarily a standard-setting organization. And so what we did, as I've also already mentioned at the opening session this morning and also in this other ITU forum, is that we have, in 2001, developed this convention against on cybercrime. It is indeed a very innovative treaty because it deals with the issue of cybercrime in a very comprehensive way. It deals with crimes committed on, against, and through the internet. Actually, few people know that this convention initially was intended to cover only crimes committed against the internet, against the machines, but it became quite clear during the negotiations that there were certain situations which required urgent and immediate response. And after all, an information society may be very high tech, but at the end of the day, like every society, it is about people and not about machines. And so we addressed immediately in this convention the issue of pedopornography. We found it very important in this convention to criminalize the various aspects of the electronic production, possession, and also distribution of child pornography. Most of our member states already criminalized the traditional production and physical distribution of pornography. But of course, with the increasing use of internet as the primary instrument for trading such material, it was necessary to make specific provisions in an international legal instrument, and that's what we did. In addition to proceeding to common definitions and to thereby to harmonize our legislations in our member states, what we do in this convention is requiring our member states to set up a network of international cooperation which operates 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. Which means that cyber criminals can be tracked down wherever they are and wherever they have committed their offense. Our starting point is that there should be no safe haven for cyber criminals. It was never our intention to make a European treaty, even if it is a Council of Europe treaty. Since its very conception, it has been drafted to serve the world, and it's not an accident that non-European states, like the United States of America, Canada, South Africa, and Japan, have not only participated in a negotiation, but also alongside the Council of Europe, but they have joined since then. And of course, it is absolutely essential that that this convention has a very broad geographical coverage, because it simply is a global phenomenon and a limited geographically restricted answer makes no or little sense. So we have 43 European and non-European states who have signed up to the convention, and 21 have ratified. And I would like to appeal once again, as I did this morning, other member states here present in the room to join this convention. The more we are, the less loopholes that remain for the cyber criminals to hide. And then we have a more recent instrument, our Convention Against Sexual Exploitation and Abuse of Children, which was opened for signature only 2 weeks ago. It is a very successful instrument in that I have witnessed personally that 25 member states on the day of the opening of the signature signed up to it, which I think is an indication of the interest this convention has for our member states and beyond. So there are a few novelties in this convention, and unfortunately the time is too short to go into the details, but I think what is very important to already is that to the extent that it deals with, again, with paedopornography, in addition to what has been criminalized in the cybercrime convention, now the mere, simple, intentional access to a paedopornographic site is criminalized, which is, I think, a very important step. Then there is the grooming, which has been now qualified as an offense, which is also quite a novelty, and that was actually not an easy part of the negotiation, but we managed, and that is very important. Grooming is a very dangerous process, which the predator on the internet gradually overcomes the child's resistance through the sequence of psychological manipulating acts. And it's also used to silence the child after the abuse has taken place. And therefore, I cannot stress enough how important I find this an added value of our convention, which will harmonize criminal law in our member states and further the protection of our children by bringing perpetrators of these serious acts to justice. The convention is also a very effective tool against sexual tourism, which is the inevitable consequence of some of these internet activities, in that it drops the dual criminality requirement, which I think is also a major step forward. But let me just not talk about the dark side. I find it very important that that internet is also a place where children learn, play, exchange, and grow up. I have mentioned this morning the creation of the e-city on our website this week, which will be a possibility for children to exercise fully the potential which they have in using internet in a positive and a constructive way, and which will make it possible for us, I think, to learn from them. The internet must guarantee everyone's enjoyment of fundamental rights and freedoms. There's no footnote in the European Convention of Human Rights which says that it applies to adults only. So actually, this is also why the Council of Europe has adopted a policy recommendation to our governments of our 47 member states to empower children in the new information and communication environment. Member states are invited to develop a coherent information literacy and training strategy which is conducive to empowering children and their educators in order for them to make the best possible use of information and communication services and technologies. Member states should ensure that children are familiarized with and skilled in new IT environment, and that to that end, information literacy and training for children becomes an integral part of school education from an early stage in their lives. That children acquire the necessary skills to create, produce, and distribute content and communications in a new IT environment, and that such skills enable children to better understand and deal with content, for example, violence and self-harm, pornography, discrimination, and racism, and behaviors such as grooming, which I've just mentioned. We need to develop pedagogical material and learning tools for the use of educators and strategies to raise awareness, inform and train educators so that they may effectively empower children in their care. States should pursue a multi-stakeholder approach to empowering children in the new IT environment. In particular, the private sector, as one of the key actors in the information society, should be encouraged to promote and facilitate children's skills, well-being and related information literacy and training initiatives. civil society actors as key catalysts in promoting the human rights dimension of the information society should be encouraged to actively monitor, evaluate, and promote children's skills, well-being, and related information literacy and training initiatives. The media should be encouraged to be attentive to their role as a vital source of information and reference for children and their educators. In conclusion, ladies and gentlemen, my message once again is a simple one. Let's make the internet a safe and better place for children. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Maud. You're going to be slipping out a little early, aren't you, about 4 o'clock, but sticking around just for the time being. That's great. Thank you very much. We're in the midst of a revolution, and the internet, like Gutenberg's printing press, has the power to transform popular access to knowledge and lead to an enormous cultural revolution. Part of the internet's promise, its appeal, especially to the young, is that it does potentially subvert things. Passive consumption of the mass media has become mass participation. The lecture is becoming a conversation. This is changing the way the younger generation see everything from knowledge, creativity, to authority. But the freedom to access, consume, or generate ideas, images, and content, the freedom to communicate across continents, also brings with it certain hazards. The most obvious being children can see too much, too young, and access illegal or unpleasant and damaging content. The aim of this open forum today is to look at what the dangers there are for children online. Can we protect children from them? We'll be looking at the international legal instruments that have been put in place, but also discussing what parents can do and what technological fixes there are at their disposal, and where the law and good parenting doesn't reach, whose job is it to make sure that children are protected online? How can we teach children to help themselves online? Now, I just want to introduce my distinguished panel. First of all, Denton Howard is from InHope. It's an international association of internet hotlines, a facility to allow people who wish to report illegal material they have found on the internet. There's Denton there in the beige jacket. At the end of the table is Dr. Marco Gerk. He's teaching criminal law with a focus on cybercrime at the Faculty of Law, and is also an expert for the Council of Europe. We have, and forgive my pronunciation, Aina Mi-Ekseid, is that good? It's almost there. She's from the Norwegian Ministry of Justice, but is a Council of Europe expert on the Convention Against Child Sex Abuse and Exploitation. We have Davina Fraumeigs. She is a Council of Europe expert on harmful content and harmful behavior, and also works at the Sorbonne in Paris. Mark Kelly, to my right, is the director of the Irish Council of Civil Liberties and is a Council of Europe expert on international human rights. To my immediate right is Matthias Treimer. He is the chair of the Council of Europe's Steering Committee on Mass Media and New Information Services and is responsible in Austria for media policy, policy on media and information society. Is that right? Okay, and also I'm going to be calling on Stephen Barkham, who's sitting over there a little later on, to detail the work he's doing with the Family Online Safety Institute. But first of all, I just want to bring in Denton, because we want to talk about what the problem is. Illegal content. Let's start with the threat. Denton Howard from InHope, could you start the ball rolling with just telling us what it is we're talking about when we're talking about illegal content? We can imagine what it is. But you and your organization, you have people reporting what they see online. Could you just frame for us what you consider to be the main problems in terms of illegal content online and what your organization does about it?
Thanks very much, David. Very nice to be here. I'd like to, first of all, say thanks very much for inviting me to speak today. My name is Denton Howard. I'm the Training and Services Coordinator for InHope. And as David mentioned, we're the Association of Internet Hotlines. We currently have 30 hotlines operating around the globe, primarily located in Europe and most westernized countries, and also through Asia and North America. We're funded, just to give you a little background, we're funded primarily through the Safer Internet Programme through the European Commission. We've been in existence since 1999. Now, the purpose of a hotline, and thus of InHope, is basically to allow the exchange of reports of online illegal content, okay, which primarily, when people refer to it, we refer to as child pornography. We prefer the expression, literally, child abuse images, which I'll get into in a moment. My role, basically, is to ensure that our members and the staff in our member hotlines have the skills and the systems to do their job properly. Now, what do they do? Hotline basically offers a central point of contact where members of the public basically can tell somebody if they found something. So that if somebody comes across a spam or somebody finds a website that has illegal or they perceive to be illegal or bad images, child pornography, call it what you want, it gives them somewhere they can tell somebody about it. And the people they tell will have the skills, one, to identify, is it illegal? Two, so that they can package it up and send it to law enforcement in the correct place and the correct format so that action can be taken as quickly as possible, okay? And a point I'm going to come back to is these are not victimless. When you see an image, it's not a victimless crime. There is a victim. We also operate, because we're operating in many different countries, the content that is hosted on the internet is not necessarily in the country in which somebody actually reports it. So we have to be able to get reports to move across international borders. Now, we've been very successful to date by our growth and the number of reports that we have issued to law enforcement, et cetera. How we've done that is we've used a partnership approach, and that means working with our key stakeholders. Now, by that, we mean government, we mean law enforcement people, we mean child welfare organizations, and we also refer to industry partners. This all helps to increase the awareness, because people can only report content if they know where to find somebody to report it. We can only do that with the support of our stakeholders. They rely on us, and we rely on them. Now, in relation to hotlines, coming back to the subject matter of today, the challenges that hotlines face are very similar to the issues raised in that David mentioned earlier. We believe that the internet is a resource that needs to be available for everybody to play, to work, to live, to conduct business. Okay, we don't see it as a scary place. We see it as a good place with some bad people. But the challenges, there's many. Okay, but to be brief, there are a few. I mentioned earlier child pornography, or as we refer to as child abuse. I said I'd come back to it later on. When people talk about child abuse images, there's a couple of things you have to bear in mind. When somebody manufactures child pornography, child abuse, there's a victim. Somebody is raped, right? A child. It's disturbing to see. Thankfully, I don't have to deal with the content itself. But it's one thing about that abuse happening, okay? Every time that image is viewed, that child is abused all over again. And that's something that has to be borne in mind, okay? Now, that's on a personal level, it's difficult to deal with, but if you think of it from a legal perspective, that has to be seen for when legislation is designed. And I'd like to compliment the Council of Europe in their efforts, basically, to harmonize legislation across Europe and hopefully the rest of the world, that definitions of what child pornography or child abuse is the same across the board. Because this is an international problem, not a national problem. The internet does not recognize a border. Basically, from that perspective, that the conventions that the Council of Europe have brought into play are very important. Now, this leads on to my main point, which is the legal black hole, which is the term I invented. This is the inconsistencies in the legislation across the globe that producers, distributors, and pedophiles and users of child pornography exploit. International prosecutions are one that they do happen, but they're extraordinarily difficult to prosecute. So one of the things that we need to try and do is through the Council of Europe to try and get a consistent legal approach. Another issue which is associated with that is the inconsistent okay, or lack of action by certain governments and certain law enforcement agencies in certain countries in basically chasing up reports or investigating any problems or complaints that are issued. In relation to the hosting, I'm going to be very politically incorrect here, and I'm going to single out somebody. We in the hotlines, much of the content that we come across is hosted in Russia. The Russian government stood up at a meeting I was at last month and said, it's not a problem. It doesn't exist. That is something which has to be changed, and that can only be changed by other governments changing their legislation and putting political pressure. I'm not going to go on anymore, but I would welcome you to visit the InHop website for more information. I also have a video clip which I would love to distribute to you to give you, it's a very high impact, and there's no images in it as such, it's about suggestion that I'd like to show everybody. But if anybody wants to look up into the internet for InHop, I'd appreciate if you'd have a look at it. There's some very good information there about more about the problem, which I could talk to you about for an hour, but I only have a limited time from David.
Okay, thanks a lot, Denton. Now, InHop's approach requires a lot of cooperation between police forces. Now, you mentioned the Cybercrime Convention. We know that this does happen in particular high-profile cases. But how does this happen at a more routine level? Marco Gerk, you worked on the Cybercrime Convention, and you're a specialist on it. Give us some background on the convention, and how is it helping police forces to cooperate?
David, thank you very much. And the Council of Europe, thank you very much for the invitation. Well, let's say even before the Convention on Cybercrime was in place, there were very successful investigations with regard to child pornography. And when you read something about a successful investigation of international or transnational crimes related to cybercrime, in, let's say, the beginning of the 90s, you will find most of them are child pornography cases. Because that was something, as you mentioned in the introduction, that was some of those, these child pornography is one of those crimes where most of the countries can agree on a certain level of criminalization. But what the Council of Europe Convention on Cybercrime does, it is enabling law enforcement agencies around the world not only to cooperate with regard to child pornography investigations on a high level, but also to cooperate in other matters. So that means the cybercrime is a global phenomenon, and offenders are intensively making use of comparative law analyses that my colleagues and myself are preparing to identify places that don't have a proper legislation in place. So it's very difficult to prove that with numbers, but it's something that is happening. And so what the Convention on Cybercrime does is, the idea of the convention is to harmonize the laws, to ensure that there are no safe havens, as was pointed out before. So we don't want those wide gaps on the landscape where the people can act from. Because for a pedophile, it doesn't matter whether he puts on the pictures from Germany, from Brazil, or from any other place. He can easily act from a country that has no proper legislation in place. The second point is, countries all over the world do not only need criminal law provisions. Same with child pornography. You need procedural law instruments. You need procedural instruments that enable law enforcement agencies to carry out investigations. And we have to address a number of challenges. One of the challenges is, well, to identify the pedophiles on the internet, to trace them back by only using IP addresses and certain information. But the Convention on Cybercrime does include those instruments that enables law enforcement agencies to prosecute those crimes, to identify the offenders. It's a continuing development. Until now, only about 20% of the pedophiles that were caught had very highly sophisticated protection instruments on their computer that made law enforcement agencies, or that caused problems for law enforcement agencies, like encryption technology. But that's something that we need to discuss in the future. So the discussion about new instruments that are necessary will continue, and the Council of Europe is actually leading this discussion. It is trying to put it into some kind of format and develop new instruments that are necessary. And the last point, how the Convention on Cybercrime improves the cooperation, is the international cooperation, the instruments for international cooperation in the convention. In the past, you know, it was mutual legal assistance, and anybody of you who has ever been involved in one of those cases, you can be sure they take months. But we don't have those months when we're talking about investigating child pornography cases in the internet or any other cybercrime offense. You sometimes only have minutes and hours. So we need different instruments, and they were for the first time, and that's something I'm teaching criminal law, so it's incredible how dramatically this convention changed the idea of dealing with international cases. For the first time, we do now have instruments that enable us to act within minutes. We do not have to write formal requests that go via the embassy to the ministry. We can call people, we can send emails and ask them to immediately react. So from my point of view, we had success in the past in very few cases. Now we have the basis for success in any kind of cybercrime investigations, especially in child pornography cases.
But Denton's point is a good one, though. For the Cybercrime Convention to truly work, it has to be universal. I mean, you could have servers in Tuvalu, and it would still be a haven for... Are you satisfied with the number of signatories?
Well, that's a tricky question. If I say no, I'm going to get a kick from the left side. But no. Let me say it this way. I was listening to an incredible presentation from Professor Kaspersen, who was actually chairing the Cybercrime Committee. And he was comparing the Convention on Cybercrime with other conventions, and he was showing that it is very successful, it is very quick. You're pointing out it's only 21 ratifications, and you're right, that's not sufficient. There are wide gaps. But there are two things. The offenders, if you look where they store child pornography, you will find out when a lot of this stuff is not only stored in Russia, a lot of stuff is stored in the United States. The reason for that is because they have a very good infrastructure. So you have very many services offering hosting services in the United States. So if we get countries like the United States and other developed countries that have a lot of infrastructure to sign and ratify the convention, as the United States did, and a lot of European countries, we have key players. It is difficult to host something, a child pornography site in an African country. It is more expensive. There are more formal requirements. So the pedophiles, the entire criminal industry is very much depending on a very few countries. So if we get those spots, we already have a very good success, and the other ones will follow, and they do at the moment. So it is too slow, seen by the development, if you compare it to the development in the internet. The ratification process is slow, but it's faster than anything else we have at the moment.
I just want to ask Maud a question because you're going to be tiptoeing off in a second. And that's do you think the Cybercrime Convention gives, well, let's look at it. Do you think that the balance of powers that police have are adequate in for investigative purposes compared to the technology that paedophiles potentially have in order to escape detection? Do you think that the Cybercrime Convention offers police forces adequate powers? This is for Maud.
Yes, my answer is affirmative. I certainly think it does have the potential. It presupposes, like in all implementation of all legal instruments, competent, available, and people to implement it. But certainly the potential is there, and I think that it is a very solid basis for fighting this kind of crime.
Now we've got Mark Kelly here, who's an international civil rights lawyer. Do you think that the balance is, are you satisfied with the balance in terms of protecting human rights, privacy, civil rights, and the investigative powers of police?
Well, I think, David, if we're focusing on the Cybercrime Convention in particular, that the balance is being struck there in an appropriate way. It's quite an interesting document in that right up front in Article 3, there's a complete ban on illegal or unlawful interception of communications. And then even before you get to any of the substantive interception powers, there's another Article 15, which is phrased in terms of procedural safeguards, and it says that these interception or controlling or surveillance type activities can only take place in accordance with national law, and interestingly that national law itself has to be in conformity with either the European Convention on Human Rights, and not to be too Eurocentric about it, because we are actually a very Eurocentric panel, I think, this afternoon. It also explicitly makes reference to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. So before you get to some of the more draconian things that you find in the Cybercrime Convention, like production orders and search and seizure of stored computer data and so on, up front you've had a statement about the procedural human rights compliance safeguards that have to be there. And in each of those substantive articles, just in case you missed the point, there's a reference back to the procedural safeguards and the need for human rights compliance. The real danger, I think, coming to it as a human rights lawyer, is in a situation in which you don't have national law that is compliant with international human rights standards, and yet these sort of interception activities are happening anyway. And there are quite a number of countries, there are many countries, as we've heard already, which are not signatories to the, or not parties to the Cybercrime Convention, in which exactly this sort of surveillance is happening. And it falls at the first hurdle. There are really three tests. It has to be lawful, it has to be prescribed by law, it has to be necessary in a democratic society, and it has to be proportionate. And there are still many of our countries in which it's not even placed on a lawful basis, but the police and the security services are doing it anyway. So I absolutely agree with Denton and Marco. There has to be no safe haven for paedophiles. But equally, as a human rights lawyer, I would say there should be no safe haven for states that want to unlawfully invade people's privacy in the online world. And so there's a real need for more signatures, more ratifications of the Cybercrime Convention, and more generally for national law to be firstly present where this activity is concerned, and secondly made compliant with international human rights standards.
We've already heard about the lengths that pornographers will go to produce child pornography, first by traveling to places where attitudes about these things are perhaps a bit more lax. Now, the internet helps them with this because it allows like-minded individuals to discreetly get in contact. Aina Mee, you know about the Council's Convention on Child Sexual Abuse and Exploitation. How does this dovetail with the Cybercrime Convention so that, as it were, potential child sex abusers who are involved in sex tourism and producing child pornography have no place to hide?
Well, I would say that the new Council Europe Convention on Protection of Children Against Sexual Exploitation and Sexual Abuse deals with sex tourism in mainly two ways. It's through criminal legislation or obligations to criminalise, and through jurisdiction clauses. I'll just give you a short overview. The convention covers having the state parties should criminalise having recourse to child prostitution. But more importantly, perhaps, is that it also covers just child sexual abuse without it being necessary to prove the commercial aspects. You don't have to prove that there was any kind of payment involved or other kinds of... I can't find that word. But it covers having sexual activities with a child below the age set for sexual relations. In any circumstance, and it also covers sexual activities where abuse is made of a particularly vulnerable situation of the child. So there is no need for it to be a commercial element. And the other part is the jurisdiction issue. The convention establishes what is called extraterritorial jurisdiction, which means that nationals of one state can be punished for acts committed abroad. And this is combined with the exemption from the principle of dual criminality, which means that you can prosecute for acts that are not being criminalized in the place where they were committed. So that's the main answer to sex tourism in the new convention. I would also mention that Article 9 encourages says that each party shall encourage the private sector, in particular the information and communication technology sector, the tourism and travel industry, and the banking and finance sectors, as well as civil society, to participate in the elaboration and implementation of policies to prevent sexual exploitation and sexual abuse of children, and to implement internal norms through self-regulation or co-regulation. So that's a different path of dealing with it. I think that's enough for now.
We recently saw the Vico case. Interpol launched an international manhunt I suppose, for someone involved in allegedly involved in producing child pornography. I mean, anyone, you know, Marco or Aina Mi, is this representative, this sort of case, where you've got this sort of manhunt and this level of success?
Well, unfortunately, it's not. When you read some of the news published after that, I mean, the Interpol was hunting for a paedophile who was putting pictures of abusing children on the internet, but of course he didn't want to be identified. So what he was doing, he was manipulating his face so you were not able to see them. And they were able to descramble it, and they were able to identify his picture. So after that, there were a number of news reports that said there's a breakthrough in the fight against paedophiles and child pornography on the internet. Unfortunately, it's not. That was the one technique used. If that person would have taken the same picture and it was simply erased his head or put a black dot on it, you wouldn't have been able to recover the data which would be necessary to identify him and to see his face. So that was one great case, a proof of how easy it is, or what is possible by using information technology to describe that picture. But it is unfortunately just one case, and the challenges that are on the other side are much bigger. There's, for example, the possibility of using encryption technology. I was just giving a lecture at the university, at the local university here in Rio de Janeiro this morning, and I was trying to explain to them that offenders are able to, when they're using encryption technology, they're able to encrypt a file in a way that you're unable to encrypt it, to decrypt it again. It will take you billions of years longer than the universe will exist, even though if you would have millions of computer systems to only render in them, it's very easy to prove that. So I think there are a lot of challenges waiting, and I'm very happy to see that, and that was something I was a little bit afraid of just a moment ago. When it comes to civil rights or protection of the human rights with regards to the convention, there are a number of things which are pointed out, critical points, but nevertheless, the Convention on Cybercrime is very much protecting that. I mean, the Council of Europe is well known for protecting human rights, and other approaches which are currently coming up with regard, for example, to challenges like encryption technology, much more. I'm just thinking about the UK Regulation on Investigatory Power Act, where it can force anybody who's using encryption technology, including paedophiles, to hand out the encryption, the key that was used for the encryption. If you don't follow the advice, you can be prosecuted and sent to prison just because of not following the order. So I think the approach of the Convention on Cybercrime is something that is giving us some standards, which are applying with our ideas of, until now, we're applying with our ideas of protecting human rights. They're giving us some possibilities of investigating, but it's for sure not the key to successful investigation in any area, like this case was proving. It was a one case example, a highly successful example, but it's unfortunately the offenders are using other techniques, and there are many out there, so it's a long fight.
Denton, yeah?
Just one comment, and this may be a little bit simplistic, but when you're dealing with child abuse images, it's criminality. Like all criminals, there are stupid criminals and there are very smart criminals. So it's a matter of the gentleman you're referring to about the case, he was a rather stupid one. Sadly, they're kind of few and far between. Sadly, there's too many smart ones out there in relation to the area of child abuse images and paedophilia. Just to bear that in mind. That's it.
Okay. I'd like to bring a rather smart lawyer in here. Mark, are you happy as in terms of civil rights with a law that makes it illegal to refuse to hand over an encryption key, given that you could potentially forget or misplace this key?
Well, I think that needs to be looked at very carefully. I'm not going to be drawn into the temptation to comment on the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act in the UK. There are questionable aspects to that act. But at least what it does do is it gives a degree of judicial oversight of the interception process. And in my own country, which in another capacity I'm paid to criticize, we don't even have an equivalent of the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act. But we know that for sure our police services are intercepting material of exactly the same sort as is subject to regulatory control in the neighboring jurisdiction. And again, not to be Eurocentric about it, we've recently come out of a seminar when we were discussing the situation in other countries in the world falling outside the Council of Europe space. And I think we do need to constantly recall that to be discussing this within the framework of Council of Europe standards is in itself quite a luxurious position to be in. So if you're dealing already with a Council of Europe member state and it has a legal framework in place, even an imperfect one, you're already far better off in terms of the protection of basic rights and liberties than the vast majority of people in the world.
Okay, thank you. I want to move on from illegal content now to, because illegal content is not the only form of content which is potentially harmful for children. There's perfectly legal content out there that you may not want children to see, or it might not be desirable or potentially harmful for children to see. Stephen Barkham, you work in an organization that has set up a rating system and a filter to empower parents, give parents a tool so that they can control what their children are seeing on the internet. Could you give us some idea, first of all, of the sort of legal content that you're worried about? And secondly, and briefly, how does your organization try to offer parents a way of controlling what their children see?
Yeah, sure. So the obvious examples include adult pornography, so pornography that is developed for adults to use, which is perfectly legal, where the models or the participants are over 18 and various things like that, but also violent images, violent games, sites promoting alcohol, drugs, tobacco, you know, chat, various different unmoderated chat sites, which again are legal. But if you look at some of the content within them, you obviously wouldn't want your seven-year-old involved in them. So there's a great deal that's covered and protected by sort of free expression rights, if you will, and in the United States specifically by the First Amendment, which is written into the Constitution. But stuff that would be termed harmful to minors is pretty much the area in which we work. Now, the labeling scheme that you mentioned, well, actually you called it a rating scheme. I'll call it a labeling scheme, and there's a distinction. And that is that we provide a labeling tool that allows content providers to self-declare what their content is, including none of the above. So there's 46 descriptors, and many sites come in and label which have absolutely nothing of harm, potential harm, but many come in and they do. So they go through an objective labeling process, answering various questions about their content. And they get a meta tag, which then they place in the header of their content.
And how does it work? It's a filter, effectively, that parents install on the computer.
Well, yes, so then we provide a free filtering tool. It's the ICRA system, the Internet Content Rating Association, which has been running since 1999. Particularly with the development of new technologies, Web 2.0, the interactive sites that we see, the filtering tools themselves have had to become much more sophisticated and use artificial intelligence. They have to use all sorts of other blocking technologies in addition to looking for labels. So we just see ourselves as part of a larger solution to a larger problem.
Matthias, you've worked on this for the Council of Europe. Do these filters work? I mean, tried using a filter the other day with, and surely not the same as the one you're talking about, but for my daughter's computer, and really the online experience wasn't an experience. There was just so much that was blocked out of relatively innocent content. I mean, what is, you've worked on this for the Council of Europe, what is your experience of them?
Yeah, go ahead. Okay, thanks, David. Just to make it clear, the Council of Europe has not developed the filter system, so it's not what we have produced, but the topic of filtering as such is one of the possibilities to protect children online was on our agenda for several years now and still is on the agenda. I just want to stress it's one of the alternatives that we are talking about, because our main direction that we're going in the Council of Europe is, of course, this question of empowerment of children, of teaching, of training, and so on, but I will come back to this maybe a little bit later. What we are actually doing in the Council of Europe is taking the topic of filter and try to create an instrument, an international instrument, a soft law instrument, maybe a recommendation, that deals with the several aspects of filtering, from, let's say, maybe the positive and the negative side. We stressed the positive sides of filtering as a means of self-regulation, of responsibility of industry, and so in several former instruments, and said, well, this might be a very useful and good way how to get on in all these very difficult questions, how this the state should really come close. But now we started a discussion in the Council of Europe to say there's also some kind a danger of some filter methods which are maybe a danger for freedom of expression as such. That there is maybe sometimes some kind of overprotection, that there is not enough transparency of filter systems, and especially there is not enough information for the users themselves, how, for example, they can make use of the filter system. We are here in a very, let's say, early stage of formulating that, but we want to go on with this in a very, let's say, rapid way, because we started an intensive debate. And let's say the aim of this should really be to have, I think, to my knowledge, it would be the first time that we would have an international instrument dealing with, a critical view from both the positive and also the critical questions of these filtering systems.
Okay. Davina, did you want to jump in here?
Yes, I wanted to jump in on the filtering aspect because I have fresh results from research we've done in France, because in France I'm part of an association that tries to be a multi-stakeholder on these issues with families, associations, educators, etc. And we had a big debate and got the internet providers to create filters, including Microsoft. So we had a big campaign called Confiance en ligne, which was about creating trust. And we put some filters for free for parental for protection of children. The results are sobering. And I'll give you just a few things. About only 60% of parents knew about these, in spite of intensive campaigns in the media and on the internet. And of the 61 who knew about it, 39% used them. And they say that the freedom, the fact that they were for free, and the fact that they were easy to install, were not motivations. The motivations were really protection of the children. So it means that even providing free software is not a solution, or is not enough of a solution, is not the full part of a solution. The parents who protected most protected the children between 8 and 12. And here again, when we talk about children, I'm afraid we have to speak about at least three ages of childhood, or else we miss the point. I mean, before 8, there's a consensus, there's specific problems of filtering and advisories, etc. Between 8 and 12, it's yet another problem. Between 12 and 16, etc. So there's at least, I would say, three ages of children. And for protection, it's really something to take into account. Because among the reasons given by parents for disinstallation, after installing, they disinstalled. More than half disinstalled these filters. They gave several reasons. Some of them were technical. It was excessive protection. It didn't take into account the fact that the computers are shared by several children in the family. And so you could not target one child compared to another. It slowed down the whole system. Access to other services was slowed down. And also lack of transparency of a filtering system. And a lot, but that may be a French specificity, a lot of parents refused to give the technological filter the upper hand on control and protection, and said, this is risky for our own sense of responsibility as parents to just leave it out there for the machine to do it. A smaller point that came up is that there's very few filters for Mac. And that's in terms of monopoly in the market, I think it's an actual question for the commercial people. So anyways, it comes into one of the things I want to say about the difficulty of creating safe havens, the difficulty of creating stable barriers and protections for children, and the fact that though those barriers are absolutely necessary, were it only because they create a debate, a public debate about them, and keep it active in the public opinion, they cannot be the only solution. You cannot give a solution to technology in the end.
I just want to put that to Steve. I want a robust defense of filtering, Stephen, because isn't this part of the texture of growing up? Isn't this part of living, learning, growing, that you go online, you see stuff that, okay, it's a bit disturbing, it's something that's challenging you, and as a good parent, it's your job to explain that.
No, I may disappoint you. I'm going to, first of all, agree with the statement here about the age of the child is extremely important. I absolutely believe that up to about the age of 11, we normally say, filtering tools are effective and useful, but beyond 11, they start to become very, very problematic. So we talk about tools and rules. So in other words, developing rules within your own household about what is and is not acceptable behavior, or the types of sites that the child might, or older child might actually end up going to. Let me also say a word about tools. I mean, there are over 100 on the market, and some are awful, truly appalling, and I won't name any today, but let me talk about two that I think are extremely interesting and useful. The first is the parental, what they call family safety settings in Microsoft's new operating system, Vista. So for the first time, we have parental controls built into the operating system. You don't have to download anything. You set it up per child, so it isn't an issue that you've got this three different kids in the house of three different ages. They just log on to their particular profile. The other I want to mention is, where's our friend from Google? Oh, yeah, here. Wherever I go, I promote the safe search facilities within Google, which very, very few people know about. If you go to preferences on the homepage of Google, you'll get to something. You have to scroll down. It's still not very evident yet. But there are three settings for the level of safety that you can go. And that's actually how kids now use the net. They don't put in URLs anymore. They just Google something, or somebody will IM them and say, hey, go look up that. But and my final point would be that that as the child ages, you're going to get more into monitoring and rules. So in other words, use the history button. Just literally go and see where the kid's been. And then say, hey, Fred, I don't think that was particularly, let's have a look at that
site. You can only do that trick a number of times before they learn how to erase the history, Kat.
One of the rules in our house, we have an 11-year-old, and she hasn't cracked it yet, is that she doesn't delete any history files. And I know how I can see if she's deleted them. We have a conversation.
Okay, now there is one good filter, and that's the kids themselves. And this is just to move on to empowerment and teaching kids about the potential hazards of what's on long, what's online, and to sift and organize how they think about it themselves. Davina, do you want to talk about this?
Yes.
Maybe I should ask you a question.
Maybe I should. Yes, it's true that one of the problems that we have is that very often in these debates about children, the children are not present.
And it's true that their perception of protection can be very different from ours. There's definitely a consensus, I think, among adults and maybe children about illegal, totally illegal crimes like sexuality and like extreme violence. But the illicit domain, the harmful and illicit, is very porous culturally and according to the age of a child. And in fact, their fears are not our fears, and their risks are not our risks. The risk they fear more is their reputation online, how their image is going to be used or deused or defaced, how bullying, how hazing is going to damage them. And that's much more difficult to filter and to protect per se as such. So there is really a difficulty of tackling this issue and informing them about their rights, but also their responsibilities. And so that's one of the challenges we've had as educators and researchers, more than as legal people, is how do we deal with this issue on an everyday life? Because that's how the children experience it on an everyday life. Something that is not as enormous as rape or pedophilia, but that can be extremely stressful or traumatizing to them and accompany them
all along their life. They don't stop being children at 18. You know, whatever you acquire early continues its traveling in your memory and in cognition. We know the damages of that, which are the same damages that pedophilia creates with children and their abuse every time an image is seen. There's no disconnect with what I'm saying. So how do we go about that? It seems to me is the reason why we changed in terms of civil society. We changed and we stopped using the term of protection because it had been attached to extremely regressive positions in civil society. Families, family associations especially, that required censorship. In Europe, and in democratic countries, it's very hard to maintain this position, though it exists in other parts of the world. There is a general consensus in Europe that you cannot censor the internet or any other media for that reason. So how do you go about that? How do you go about changing the idea that the family has projected as being a center of authority and extreme protection to something more open and more active? So this is why we changed our rhetoric in terms of activism, and we moved to ideas of empowerment and ideas of well-being instead of ideas of risk and ideas of threat and of protection. It's a calculated risk that we're taking. We're not separating ourselves completely from the legal aspect, don't get me wrong, but what we're saying is that as educators, as families, as parents, we have to promote also other ways of controlling, for the child to control his own identity online and to promote it in an active and dynamic way. Hence the idea of well-being and hence the idea of empowerment, which is both in the French term, not the English term, autonomy, that's the English version, responsibility, that's the French version, and I hope you keep the French one. because I think it's more encompassing of what the child should be. So that also means changing a lot of our visions and our patterns about many things. About the child, in the first place, the child is not a victim only. He can be an aggressor these days. He's not a demon, but he can be criminal. We have to accept it. So that means that we really have to realize that they can have different roles, some of them being actively damaging and harmful to themselves and to other children, using their authority and their reputation among peers to encourage damaging behavior about, as you know, distorting sites on anorexia and suicide, etc., etc. So this is something that we have to take into account and have a new vision of the child also as a very active partner that can also build its own self-protective measures and can use other children for self-protection. This is something that we've underrated a lot. They will trust more rankings made by their own peers than rankings made by the parents or made by the industry. And so we have to integrate that in our patterns to promote their self-empowerment.
Okay, thank you. Aina Mi, you wanted to go? In fact, we've got four panelists wanting to come in. So we did very briefly, Aina Mi, and then Mark and Matthias.
Okay, I'll be brief, and it's easy because Davina touched upon several of the issues that I wanted to bring up, because we've been focusing so much on protecting children from content or from adults wanting to harm them, whereas we should also focus on protecting children from themselves, because they don't understand the consequences or the responsibility or the risks they're facing when they're publishing content on the internet about themselves or about their friends, publishing images, etc. The convention doesn't, provide a perfect solution to this. I would just point out Article 6 in the Convention, that's on education of children, where it is stated that children should receive information on the risks of sexual exploitation and sexual abuse
And it is specified that especially those involving the use of the new information and communication technology. And I think it's important to stress that this information should also involve how they need to protect themselves from acts that they do themselves. I would also mention very briefly that we had a controversial issue concerning this on Article 20 on child abuse images, where some delegations wanted children, or I mean 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds, children above the age for legal sexual relations, but below the age for what is considered to be a child in child abuse images. Some delegations wanted these children to be able to make public pictures of themselves because they didn't consider this to be harmful. Well, I must say that I disagree, because once you publish it, it's always there, and you don't really understand the consequences of your acts. Thank you.
Okay, Mark, did you want to come in?
Yes, maybe just to stay with what's innovative about this new Council of Europe Convention on Protecting Children from Sexual Exploitation. Annelied mentioned Article 6 there, but there's also Article 9, which actually the drafting is a delight to those of us who are fans of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, because there's some language there that's been directly borrowed, I think, from the UN Convention. And it's an echo of Davina's notion of the three ages of childhood. It says each party shall encourage the participation of children according to their evolving capacity in the development and implementation of state policies, programs, and other initiatives concerning the fight against sexual exploitation and sexual abuse of children. So children are in there clearly as stakeholders alongside government, civil society, the media, and others. But Article 9 actually only speaks about the responsibility of the state to respect the autonomy of the child. I actually prefer the word autonomy to the word responsibility. For some reason, responsibility just has a slight overtone of control about it. I think autonomy is more about individual liberty, but we can have that debate
Anglo.
About English and French afterwards, Davina. But in a multi-stakeholder environment like this, I really do want to put the question back to you, and I hope we are going to open the floor at some point
If we have 10 minutes at the end, yeah, definitely.
To say, you know, what are other stakeholders doing here to make sure that we're able to hear the voice of the child where this is concerned? That's what the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child requires of us. The language is now there in the Council of Europe Convention as well. And just look across the various stakeholders that are here in the private sector, Bebo and Facebook and online communities of that sort. These are probably the biggest single advance in terms of children being able to exercise their right to freedom of association and assembly that has ever happened in history. And yet are the policies that regulate the conditions under which children can participate in those human rights proofed? Is exclusion from those communities something that is subject to the sort of safeguards that I was talking about before? Is it necessary? Is it lawful? Is it proportionate? And so on. The media tend to concentrate, perhaps understandably, on some of the more egregious violations of children's rights that happen in the online world. And so grooming type events and the pursuit of pedophiles and so on, these things dominate the headlines. But is the media playing its part in ensuring that there's a degree of media literacy that there could be, that children themselves know about, for example, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, perceive of themselves as rights holders? And maybe finally, civil society, a sort of mea culpa. Are we doing enough in civil society to do the kind of simple things that we could be doing to make available information in an easily digestible form that can help children to understand that they are stakeholders, or they certainly ought to be stakeholders in this process? They have rights, they ought to be consulted. And also, as many of the other speakers have been saying, that often the biggest danger to children isn't the nasty pedophile sitting in the dark somewhere, it's other children who are filming each other, assaulting each other on their mobile phones or whatever. I think there's a lot more probably that civil society could be doing as well. I know that certain organizations like the ones in which Davina is involved are already producing material of that sort, but I think that we could be doing more. And just to conclude, I mean, for me personally, I think a real human rights-based approach here needs to go beyond just talking about the standards that are in international treaties, and it needs to recognize, genuinely recognize, the child as a rights holder in his or her own right.
Matthias, I want you to deal with that. I mean, this is a notion of children being educated, being told, first of all, what their rights are, but also being given an education so they're not just media savvy, but internet savvy, so that they know that the ephemera they're putting online today is going to follow them around. And we've already heard that university admissions staff and potential recruiters have been trawling Facebook, looking at YouTube to see whatever nasties people are getting up to better judge whether this candidate should deserve this post or this place at a university. Give us some idea. I know that there's a project going on in Austria at the moment. It's actually part of the curriculum, isn't it?
Before we'll go on this, I have to do just some words in the Council of Europe's word, because I just want also to inform all of us here that really this question of empowerment, empowering children as, let's say, really an key element of our information society policy in the Council of Europe, it has been very interesting within the last years. So there were, for example, actions like Pan-European Forum in Yerevan in 2006, that was followed by a committee of ministers recommendation on empowerment. And it's really worth reading this recommendation, because when you mention Austria, it was also very helpful for Austria to start a project on, I call it an integrative educational media project that started a horizontal project integrating media education in very different subjects at schools, starting even mathematics, when they start with maybe figures about media companies and so on, and going on, of course, with economy policies, with history, with languages, skills, and all that. So I think it's really worth looking at the different Council of Europe's work so far. Especially there was also a very successful internet literacy handbook, which I'd like to recommend to you. I mentioned this internet literacy handbook because there's one aspect, and this is this human rights aspect that was mentioned right away. I think it was very interesting to say, you said it's important that we do not only protect children by the maybe sometimes nasty world of the adults, but also to protect, I wouldn't say protect, but maybe educate children that they also have to be protected by their colleagues and by their, let's say, fellows. When you look at all these YouTube, and so I recently was at a seminar and they showed us an example. When you print in the word vomit, yes, the English word vomit, we found about 10,000 hints, and most of them were children between the age of 10 and 15 vomiting at parties. Well, that might be funny, but it's a big question of dignity, how to deal with that. Yes, the person that is the poor hostage of such a, let's say, of such a short, maybe 20 seconds, view on YouTube, nevertheless, can be seen worldwide, how is in this critical situation. I'm sure this is not the role of the state to regulate this, of course. Nobody claims that. But what is important, that media education is human rights education. That you say you have, well, this freedom of expression of your own, but as Article 10 also says, you also have a responsibility when you make use of your freedom of expression. And I think especially that has to be done in the internet age. Thank you.
Marco, did you want to? Sorry, you've been waiting really patiently.
Let's jump into the discussion.
Okay. Well, let's move it on. I know that Davina, you wanted to talk. Perhaps you could address this issue of education. I mean, how do you actually structure this? What do you do? Do you make it part of the curriculum? What do you do?
Good question. And we haven't solved it, you were saying. Austria is the only country in Europe, and I think worldwide, that has a comprehensive media education curriculum. for historical reasons, I think a lot has to do with how culture considers children. The fact that there's lots of pornographic sites in Russia is because there was no recognition of family laws in totalitarian Russia. So it takes a lot of reflection of a society to move into legal terms. Before that, the minds have to be changed. Anyways, we're all pushing, especially in the Council of Europe, for a harmonized curriculum for media education all over the region and hopefully other parts of the world. UNESCO is also working with the Council of Europe on that. What we are all fighting for is for what we call an encompassing, very inclusive definition of media education, so that it's no longer just considered as sort of newspapers or as the internet, but that all media should be put there, because even with convergence, traditional media will be online and children have to be prepared to be critical about them and participative about them. So that's what an inclusive and encompassing media education definition would be. We have renounced, for labor reasons, to create a discipline that would be called media education, because it would add to the children's day and would add to the government's cost. So the idea is to integrate it as part of the basic competencies in all existing disciplines, which means training all teachers, which means an awful lot of time. Basically, in France, we've calculated by the time all our teaching population would be ready, we would be in 2061. And by then, who knows what the web will be? And we certainly know it will not be like the thing we're seeing now. So indeed, other measures have to be taken at civil society level, among parents. All actors have to act together. So that's another point. And it's true, the third point for us is that media education has to be really embedded in human rights, because of the connectedness that is necessary to create between these different rights and responsibilities very early in the child. And not connectivity, I'm not talking about a technical connection here, I'm talking about connectedness, people talking to each other, adults and children, intergenerational. And so my tendency would be to say that, to refer to the Bill of Rights, media education is like the First Amendment. Without it, you cannot reach the human rights. It has to be put into the children's mind very early, if you want them to continue respecting, fighting for human rights. Maybe more importantly, because that's something I fear that human rights in Europe and beyond might become an ideology. And we know, and we've been back from ideologies in the 20th century. So my worry is really to keep what I call human rights plastic, which is to say adaptable, lived in, associated to changes in society and technology, so that they keep scaling up, so that they keep empowering us through the different generations of change that technologies are going to bring. So, and this can only be done via education and starting at a very early age. So media education, yes, preschool, not at the end, the way it's done in some countries when kids are 16 or 17 and it's a pre-professional whatever, access to computers, to web mastering and all that. No, preschool. Start from there. And okay. So that's what I would stop here. So that
okay,
the
great.
Discussion.
I just want to, you know, really, because I want to give 10 minutes for questions, because this is a really good chance for the audience to speak to the panelists. But just finally, I want to move on to advertising. And we've already seen that there have been reports in the British press anyway that with terrestrial television stations, first of all in Britain, banning junk food ads on the television, which are aimed at children, and I think it's Scandinavian countries are just banning all advertising in general on children's television. So advertising dollars are beginning to move onto the internet. What do the panelists think about this? Do children need to have an education in the power of advertising, that these messages are not necessarily that you should something you should immediately respond to. They're not going to like being told that you're malleable and you'll do whatever you know whatever the advertisers tell you to do. How do we deal with this? Anyone? Davina.
There's too many legal people on this panel, but anyways, I hope I'll speak also in their not against what they're saying. Commercial advertising is protected legally, so there we go. So the only way out is indeed to educate children to be critical about the civil society and the commercial society in which they are. Unfortunately, research shows that teaching them to be critical doesn't make them switch off their computers, but it may make them change a little bit their habits. And in countries where there is media education, there is more awareness of the power of advertising. So it speaks for itself. It's not a danger for the commercial entities because people and kids will not disconnect, but they may be a bit more critical. What I worry about, and maybe this is the last one I'd like to make, is that more and more today on internet, your identity, your image, images about you are being connected to advertising. You've seen the recent controversy on YouTube and how profiles are being sold without consulting people. This is where I would think the crux of legislation should come back. And partly what I'm fighting for with some other people is the creation of an e-portfolio where people actually can control throughout their lifetime their image, the general image, not just visual, but their different aspects of their digital identity, and can deny, can come back on aspects they haven't controlled, and can actually have ads that they don't want to be associated with removed from whatever images, videos, etc. they put on the internet. At the moment, people have no choice. You have ads attached to your productions without choosing the sector, for instance, in which your ads are going to be put. This has to be, I'm afraid, legalized or definitely become part of a public opinion debate and campaign.
Okay,
stop.
Great. Can I cut you off there? Let's have some questions from the floor now. So young lady there, first up.
Yes, I am representing here Russia. Yes, which is
welcome.
Yes, thank you. Which is not the biggest, but the second biggest country which provides a host for child pornography. And I'm representing a civil council of Central Russia, which is a council of non-governmental organization. And we are very concerned with this issue. And we are creating a program which is supposed to be alternative to governmental program, but we close in interaction and we have a good experience of pushing the changes which we want into the reality. So first of all, I would like to ask the specialists who are here to help us with your expertise, your ideas, your information, because there are not real, really many experts on child pornography and struggle against it in Russia, because there was no problem like this in the Soviet time. So I would like to announce this, our initiative, and I still I have to ask a question, otherwise the chair will be mad
at me. Yeah, please, please.
So yes. The question is, if you, we are organizing, our council is planning, maybe with, probably with the government, to a conference on protecting child against child abuse on the internet. So my question, if you would like to come, if the dates will be suitable to you.
Oh, that's great. Well, you've got, an open invitation there. Okay. Can I come? No, that's very kind. Does anyone want to address what Russia ought to do? I mean, very very quickly, please, Marco. Yeah.
Just want to say, I've been in 2004 in Krasnoyarsk during the winter. I have to say, and there are approaches. I think to say Russia is not moving is not right. There are a lot of movements, but it's just the question who finally decides and if they are moving. So I think there. If this is an invitation to start a discussion which could lead to some positive outcome, I think it's great. It's more than welcome. But it's very difficult to get the right people moving there.
And of course, the denial that there is child pornography might just be a lack of awareness. It's not necessarily. Sorry, Davina, because Aina Mee wanted to come in. Did you want to come in?
Yeah. Yes, just very short. I would just say that although criminalization is important and the criminal justice response is important, I would just emphasize the need for a broader concept of prevention of sexual exploitation and sexual abuse. And personally, I believe that prevention has to take into account social issues. It needs to be viewed in a more general society social issue, not just through criminal legislation. Thank you.
Yeah, go on. Sorry, Davina after Mark.
Yeah, I'm wondering, can you just remind me, you would know, is Russia a signatory of the Cybercrime Convention? And if not, then maybe that would be a good starting point. Russia is a very significant member state of the Council of Europe. This is a convention which is open to member and non-member states, and that would send a very clear signal at political level that Russia genuinely is committed to tackling a problem which it's very agreeable to hear acknowledged in a forum such as this.
Okay, Davina, briefly.
Yes, just quickly, I agree, there's prevention, and that's feasible in a broader concept of what's the child and the child's role and utility in society. And it's true that Russia has to tackle that issue after 70 years of totalitarianism. There are actions. There's been actions on the media at defining the criteria by which you can describe a document as being pornographic. And so Russians are working on their own denials. And there's a very active Russian Association for Media Education led by Alexander Fedorov that is extremely productive at the moment and extremely networking a lot within Russia and with the rest of the European Union. So there are things happening in Russia.
Okay, Marco, did you want to add something?
Russia did not sign the Convention on Cybercrime, and there are some, it's quite interesting, most of the provisions don't seem to be a problem for them, but there is one provision where we, every time we meet the Russian delegation, we have intensive discussion. That's the question about, are foreign authorities allowed to access data stored in Russia without the permission of the Russian government? So, it's a tough job. We have people here. We have Jean-Charles here who's representing the department that is dealing with cybercrime issues, and he has a tough job when it comes to Russia.
Okay. Does any more questions, please? Which one was first? The lady with the red hair with the orange shawl. There you go.
Thank you. Well, I'd like to thank all of you because it's been a very enlightening panel and very discussion. I would like to ask whether the new Convention on Protection Against Child Abuse and Exploitation is open for countries outside the European Council. I come from Costa Rica, and we will be more than interested to lobbying for the country to join the convention. And we address the issue of sex tourism. We coordinate the Code of Conduct project in Costa Rica. It would be a fantastic tool for us. Secondly, this is related to the force you all have within the Council of Europe. How viable would be to take these issues to discussions when Europe and Latin America, because I think there are very few of us from Latin America and only me from Central America, discuss cooperation agreements. Central America right now is starting the discussion of the association treatment with the European Union, just started last week. And there are components for the first time. It's not only a commercial association agreement, it's a political and has a component on social cohesion, which is flexible enough to integrate different aspects that affect social cohesion in a nation. And I think it would be extremely important. It's issues like this, in terms of the leadership that the European Union is taking in these issues, could be brought to the political table of discussion in Central America, so that will help us foster the efforts that the countries are doing in terms of improving the legislation, improving law enforcement capacity, and improving facing a new environment where our kids are developing now, which is the cyberspace.
Okay, but thanks for that question, because but I think there's a bit of a confusion involved in it, because the Council of Europe is very different from the European Union. Your question, I mean, I shouldn't be answering this, but Marco, could you answer this? It's open to everyone, isn't it?
It is open, and there is a very, I think I'm going to leave that to you, but just to mention, Costa Rica is one of the countries that was just invited to sign the Convention on Cybercrime. So you're one of the countries that's very much, very closely connected to the Council of Europe, and is very intensively following what there is happening. So I think there would be a great advantage if you would not only sign the Convention on Cybercrime, but also this approach.
Okay. Yes, go ahead.
Good afternoon. I'm a federal prosecutor from Brazil. I think she told about cooperation in Latin America. I think this kind of cooperation involves a two-way route. In one hand, we host lots of websites with child pornography, and our criminals cooperate to diffuse, to distribute lots of this kind of material. And on the other hand, Brazilian people use almost 8% of internet users in Brazil use internet services like Google or Yahoo and Microsoft, and use this kind of service to practice to commit crimes, including child pornography. And I'm not sure if the We don't have this kind of cooperation that we want to, including a cooperation of this this service providers. And my issue is to find how can we discuss a cooperation without a cybercrime convention here in Brazil, because Brazil hasn't signed yet the Budapest Convention. And I think is it possible? In a very practical point of view, have this kind of cooperation even without the formal signature.
So you want to know if is there any leeway for informal cooperation outside the Cybercrime Convention? Do you know of this, and how would they go about it?
Yeah, and I would like here to give my number and my address and my email address to receive this kind of
sort that out afterwards.
Reports.
Try it very quick. Well, of course there are possibilities. If you know somebody in another country, you can call them and just check if that is possible. There are informal ways. There is a G8 network that you can use the contact points. But the thing is, you will need the same legal elements in both countries that are cooperating, and that's where you need the Convention on Cybercrime. So I would just like to encourage you to come tomorrow to the session about the Convention on Cybercrime and just follow that, because I know there are a lot of activities going on, including Brazil. So there are discussions going on in Brazil whether to sign the Convention on Cybercrime. And I think it's not even a question whether to sign, but when to sign it. So I hope that we will get you as a full member, because then you will have the entire possibilities of cooperation.
Okay, let's take another two questions. This gentleman here has had his hand up for a long time.
Thank you. I'm the chairman of the regulator from Namibia. My question is that I was listening to all the panelists talking about cybercrime, especially child pornography, etc. But my concern is that you find that most of the pedophiles right now are targeting developing countries. What are you doing to help developing countries to counter pedophiles who are using those countries to commit cybercrime?
Okay, that's a good point. Pedophiles will often exploit a socioeconomic imbalance, won't they, in order to abuse children. Ayinami, do you want to deal with that?
Yes, just very briefly. I think I would just refer to what I said on child sex tourism. I think many of the same issues arise when they... if they're not tourists, but they commit or they use gaps in legislation in other countries to commit offences. I think the jurisdiction clauses in the convention should help states, parties to the convention, to prosecute their own nationals. But, I mean, that's the limit, really.
Okay, Marco.
Just very quickly, I just wrote a cybercrime guide for developing countries for the ITU, which is addressing especially, which is trying to focus on the special demands, because it's really true, this they're facing the same offenses, but there are different challenges there. So this will be released at the end of the year, so that will be available, I think, for download on the ITU website, or you simply contact the ITU or contact me, and we will make this available for you. It is referring, for example, to the Convention on Cybercrime, explaining this as a model law, and in addition, explaining further crimes and taking regard to the special demands of the countries.
Yes.
Good afternoon. I came from Argentina, one other developing countries. And referring to the comment, the people from Brazil and being Argentina and not signatory of the convention also, I would like to ask if the creation of CSERTs, because under umbrella of the OES in South America and Central America are moving to develop a CSERT center of response of incident, technical incident, it could be another way to develop the cooperation beside or in the meantime the other countries ratify the convention.
Yeah, Marco?
The CSERT is a great invention. It's doing a great job with regards to research and the technical level. I think it is not the right institution to be used for legal purposes. But Jean-Charles Decolle is, again, the one you will need to speak to, because he will go to Argentina on Wednesday and speak to the local authorities there. They are just developing the national legislation, and I think there is a good chance that they are going to become party of the convention, so this problem will be solved within the next weeks. That would be wonderful. Putting a little bit of pressure on Jean-Charles.
Okay.
Yes. My name is Pierre Lang. I come from the Safer Internet Programme of the European Commission. And I would just like to raise your attention that in Europe there are things going on in order to make the internet a safer place for children. So we, for instance, we run the European Network Awareness Nodes. There are 25 of those. We also run or fund the InHope network of hotlines. So there are also things going on in Europe in order to raise awareness and to reduce the amount of illegal material being circulated online. In particular, I would like to raise your attention to two things that are currently going on.
They're banging at the door outside. Are you going to ask a question to the panel?
No, but I will be very, very, very quick.
Okay.
You were talking about filtering solutions. There is no easy answer to filtering solutions. However, for the moment, the European Commission is having a benchmark study concerning filtering solutions so that we will know what we can do in the future. The second thing I would like to say is that there is also this year a qualitative study of children, which was just launched, which says a lot about how children use the internet, how they perceive risks, and how they deal with the risks. So if you're interested, just try and update yourself on our website.
Okay, thanks a lot. And there's a gentleman there who has his hand up there. Just behind you, behind the man in the green. There you go.
Thank you. My name is John Stumness, and I'm a detective superintendent, and so somehow the operational arm of the Cybercrime Convention. We have been dealing with this issue since 1993, before the internet, so everything we see now is nothing new. But I would like to, you know, raise a question, and this is not to be pessimistic in any way, but I try to count up all the 24/7 services that we have now. It's like we have the Interpol, Europol, through the Schengen system, we have a national responsibility, and we also have the virtual global task force, you know, asking for a 24/7 service. And now the Cybercrime Convention, which also calls for a 24/7 service. And this is the question, I really don't see what will we gain by having another 24/7 service? What will be the impact of the Cybercrime Convention? help.
Okay, I think sadly it's going to have to be Marco again, isn't it? Go on, go ahead.
It's an excellent point. You don't need to implement a new one. You can use the existing structures you have. What is new with this one is the 24/7 network point needs to have certain possibilities to immediately react. And the existing 24/7 network points, for example, cannot order the quick freeze procedure, which is laid down in Article 16. So what within the implementation of the contact point, the 24/7 network point, you will then give them the authority to do some certain investigations right away. So that would be the difference to the existing structure, but you can use the existing structures with regard to the personnel and the institutions they're implemented in.
Okay, we're going to end it there, but just before you go, because there are so many questions on the Cybercrime Convention, you might want to go along to another open forum by the Council of Europe on the Cybercrime Convention. That's tomorrow in Versailles 2, yeah, and that's an early start, 8:30 to 10. So if you want to hear more about the Cybercrime Convention, and the bulk of the questions have been about that, so you want to hot-footed along to there. They're banging on the door now. I just want to say thank you to Stephen, Marco, Denton, Davina, Aina, me. I managed to get the pronunciation just at the end there. Mark and Matthias. Thank you very much. Bye.